So we've been covering a lot of background material. Let's see if we can actually get into the meat of Matthew 24. And if we're lucky, hey, maybe we'll get to Matthew 25 today. We'll see. I'm not optimistic.
That's on that.
Anyway, so people have been asking about my Israel trip. I got canceled at the last minute, so I was really sort of bummed about that, although less pressure on me, so there's always a positive side, right? So maybe a little, who knows? So I'm not going to believe it until I'm on the flight over there. Maybe then I won't even believe it until I land, or you know. But anyway, so we're in a section of Scripture called the Olivet Discourse, which you'll find in Matthew 24 and 25, which most people think of the Olivet Discourse, but you get something very similar in Mark 13, and like I know Nathan is going to be preaching on that sometime this summer, so we talked about that, so because it's in Mark, and then Luke 21 also, and Luke 21 is kind of the same material, but it's some key differences, and we've talked a little bit about that, and we'll talk about that some more. So anyway, so we'll be jumping around, but mainly we'll be in Matthew 24. We'll start in Luke 21. So we just got through Passion Week and through Easter and all that. So as you know, the context of Matthew 24 is during Christ's Passion Week. He is very close to being crucified. Right? He's in the last week of his earthly life. Before he's going to be crucified. So, and in Matthew 21, Jesus has entered Jerusalem on a donkey, as prophesied by Zechariah 9, right? And we know in Revelation 20 or 19, he's going to come back on a white horse. But on his first coming into Jerusalem, he enters into Jerusalem on a humble donkey. And this is what is prophesied in Zechariah. And we know in Christ's first coming, he came to give his life as a ransom, as it says in the Gospel of Mark, for many. And he came to... Yeah, go ahead.
Quick question on the donkey. I've always heard humility associated with the donkey.
Yeah.
Recently, I was reading in the Old Testament a commentary on it that the kings rode a donkey when they came in peace, mm-hmm. horse when they were coming in war.
Okay. Interesting.
Have you ever heard that?
I have.
No, and the reason I get the humble part, because that's what it says in Zechariah 9. Let's see, where is that exactly? Zechariah 9. Yeah, he says, "Behold, your king is coming to you." This is Zechariah 9:10. "Righteous and having salvation is he." And it says, "Humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." So there's actually two there. There's a donkey and a colt. So I don't know if they're riding side by side or what. But there it mentions the humility aspect of it. Okay. Now, if there's more to that, I don't know. Okay. There may be. So... A young dog. Yeah, never been ridden before for some reason. But there is this aspect of humility that Christ is coming in as king. And so, you know, the Jewish eschatology is when Christ would return, is that he would immediately establish his kingdom, right? They're waiting for him to overthrow the Roman authorities and establish his kingdom right there and then. And we'll talk some more about that. But we know now that Christ had to first come, he had to first suffer and die. In fact, he chides some of his disciples after his resurrection. Didn't the scriptures say the Messiah first had to suffer and die, right, before that happened? So in his first coming, he comes to humble himself, give himself as a ransom for many. He has to suffer and die. He has to procure salvation by dying on a cross first, right? Yeah.
Where in the Old Testament do the Jewish scholars get their controversy?
Oh, right. So, in fact, many, many, many places. And in fact, also in Zechariah. I mean, if you just skip forward a little bit, he says, "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil will be taken and divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses plundered, and the women raped. Half the city shall go out of exile, and the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city." And it goes on that day there shall be no light, cold, or frost. No, there shall be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but evening time there shall be light. And, anyway, I'm kind of I don't know why I picked that one out of a blue, but and earlier in Zechariah 13, it has his second coming. But all through, if you look at all the times that Christ comes, it's always a sense of deliverance, that he's going to throw off the yoke of their oppressors. He's going to establish a kingdom, and everyone's going to come to Jerusalem to worship God. So the conditions when he returns, like, let's see, let's take Isaiah 2 as an example. This is one of those cases you ask a question, I've got too much information to know what to zero in on. This is Isaiah 2, and he says, "It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be lifted up above the hills, and the nations shall flow to it, and many people shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations, and he shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore.'" I mean, this is the idea that at some point the king is going to reign and everyone's going to be subservient to him, and people are going to come to him for wisdom, but law, you know, there's going to be justice and law, there's going to be no more war, and that's kind of the expectation when Christ would come. He would set up that particular kingdom. Right? So, and that's the Jewish expectation that's happened. And just, yeah, anytime you talk about the coming, the day of the Lord, like the day of the Lord, like if you read in Joel about the day of the Lord, this is the time when Christ is going to return. And, you know, the moon will turn to blood, the sun will turn dark, and there's going to be this coming terrible, great, wrathful day of the Lord. Is Jeremiah 30, this time of Jacob's trouble, right? That's the expectation, that there's going to be this oppression. And Christ is going to return, there's going to be a battle, and then he's going to set up his kingdom, and everyone's going to come to, and Jerusalem's going to be the center, and everyone's going to come to Jerusalem to see the Messiah, and the world's going to be, the nations are going to be subservient to him. I mean, that's the expectation in Psalm 2 for sure, right? You know, he says, "I will tell the decree. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, O kings, be wise, O warren rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and trembling, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all those who take refuge in him." So there's an example. He's going to rule with a rod of iron. He's going to, and so that's the expectation, that Jesus is going to come. He's going to set up the kingdom. In fact, they expect the kingdom to come right away. In fact, again, I'm going to bring that up again. They expect the kingdom right away. And Christ actually gives them a parable because that's the expectation. But when he comes, but there's this idea that he first has to suffer and die. When he comes the first time, nobody sees him, right? So he's ignored, he's rejected, and he suffers and he dies. When he comes again, it says every eye will see him. Right? It says in Revelation 1, every eye will perceive him. When he comes again, there'll be no doubt about who he is and what he's there for. So, but anyway, so the whole context of Matthew 24 is he's in the last week of his life. So his mission has been to go to Jerusalem. Like we were studying in Mark, you know, once you get to Peter's confession, he says, "I have to go to Jerusalem. I have to be rejected. They're going to beat me, flog me, spit on me. And then they're going to crucify me, but I'm going to rise again on the third day." Right? That's his mission towards Jerusalem. He's now entered Jerusalem for the last time, at least before his crucifixion anyway. Obviously, the whole point of this class is he's going to return to that point. So, and in John, there's this really interesting comment. It says, in the beginning of John, he goes into Jerusalem for an earlier time that he goes into Jerusalem, and he overturns the money changers' tables for the first time, and they're asking, "What authority do you have to do this?" And he says, he replies to them, "Destroy this temple in 3 days, I will raise it up. That's the sign I have." Yeah, and of course it says there that he's really talking about his death and his resurrection. And the disciples, it says, they understood that later, after his resurrection, they understood what he was saying. Right? But the fact that he's actually talking this idea of destroying the temple, right, and raising it up, he's speaking about himself. But he's talking about the destruction of the temple being himself in some sense. And this is what amillennialists will use. Like I've heard, Sproul, R.C. Sproul, will use this verse. It says he doesn't expect the temple to ever be rebuilt. The temple that mattered was Jesus' temple. He died. And so that's kind of the idea. So we're not, from his point of view, an amillennial point of view, that we're not waiting for a physical earthly temple to be rebuilt, because that temple is Christ when he rose again. That was the temple. So that's an amillennialist argument that they would use in that. But of course, there's too much other scripture that has to deal with the fact that there will be a literal temple that will be built, and it's not just the temple of Jesus' body. But he does say that, and that is interesting. He's sort of alluding to the fact of the temple being destroyed. So turn to Luke 19. And now this, I'm going to pick up in verse 41. This is right after the triumphal entry. So he's entered in, and he weeps over Jerusalem. It says, when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children with you, and they will not leave one stone another in you, because you did not know the time of your visitation. Things going on with this technology here. Okay. So there Jesus is, as soon as he enters Jerusalem, he's weeping over Jerusalem, and he's actually talking about the destruction of the temple, not one stone being left on another, and the city is going to be destroyed, and it's going to be surrounded. Well, this, as I've already covered in some great detail, this is exactly what happened when Titus and the Romans in AD 70 destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, right? So Jesus is talking about, and he's foretelling the destruction of the temple. Yeah. So, and notice this is the first thing. This is the discussion that he's having as he's entering Jerusalem. He's about to die himself. And if you look, turn to Luke 21, which is, he says, and while some were speaking of the temple, how it is adorned with noble stones and offerings, he said, as for these things you see, the days will come when there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. He's basically saying Herod's temple was amazing. I mean, they tell Jesus after he says, destroy this temple in 3 days, I'll rise it up. They said, well, it took us 46 years to build this because Herod started renovation on this in about 20 BC. Herod has been renovating the temple that was originally the second temple, which was started by Zerubbabel. He had renovated it. It was a magnificent structure. It was beautiful, adorned with gold and large and visible from a great distance. And so here he's saying that not one stone is going to be left upon another. And according to Josephus, that once the Romans had finally destroyed it, you couldn't even tell that there was a city there. I mean, it was completely decimated. So it was a very complete destruction. So Jesus, you also have this, if you flip to Matthew 24, you have a very similar statement. He says, in verse 24, verse 1, he says, Jesus left the temple and was going away. So he left the temple. He'd speak in the temple, and then he'd go across the Kidron Valley of the Mount of Olives in the evening. He says, when his disciples came to the point out to him the buildings of the temple, and in other parts you see the disciples are mesmerized, but wow, Jesus, look at this temple, how amazing it is, right? This is that God was present. This is where they had their sacrifices and their daily sacrifice. This is where the presence of God was manifest to them, was through this temple. And they're all amazed by this. But he answered them, you see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And so to us, this is history. We know the story. You know, Vespasian came in 66 AD, right, and came through and went through Syria and Tyre and Sidon and down through Galilee, down on the coast through Caesarea and down through Idumea, and had Jerusalem surrounded. And by the time that they were going to attack Jerusalem, then suddenly Nero died, committed suicide, and that's when Vespasian decided to leave Titus there and go back to Rome. And that's when you had the year of the four emperors, because there were four emperors that were short-lived reigns. And then finally Vespasian became the one that became the next emperor, and he left Titus in charge. So there was this time in AD 66. Now, a lot of people, when Christ warns them that when you see Jerusalem surrounded, a lot of people think that's when people fled in 66 AD, because there would have been ample time to get out of there, away from there, before they come back, before Titus comes in AD 70. So, in fact, it's during that time that Josephus is taken away captive as a slave by Vespasian. And he's a slave for a while, and eventually, I think largely because he tells Vespasian that he's going to be emperor, and Vespasian likes him, and Josephus likes Vespasian. And in fact, he takes on the Vespasian name of Flavius, because that's the Flavian dynasty that started with Vespasian, and so we know him as Flavius Josephus, and that's so he's left, and then Titus goes down to Egypt, right, and then they gather their forces, and it takes them another 4 years before they gather their forces from Alexandria and come up to Caesarea and come back and destroy Jerusalem in AD 70, and that's what we talked about in great detail. So Christ is giving in a prophecy that was very apropos to the moment at that point. Right? There's going to be this destruction of the temple, and we know historically that happened in the Jewish revolt in AD 70, which we've talked about in some great detail. So then, going back to Matthew 24, the disciples now asked a series of questions. Right? This sort of shocks the disciples, and they want to know, well, first they want to know, when will this happen? So they ask a series of questions, and we call this all of it discourse, because in Matthew 24, this takes place on the Mount of Olives. So this is, and Jesus is with his disciples, and he's giving them a private overview of these things, and they ask these questions. And in Luke 21, it seems to me, in Luke 21, he's giving a public discourse where everyone's listening. So there's going to be some. So I think it's kind of like the difference between the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain. They're very similar sermons, but I think they were given in two different places, right? This. So I think in Luke, he's given this sermon on at the temple, and in Matthew 24, he's giving this a private version of the sermon to his disciples. Now, so the first thing they want to know is when this will happen. Their expectation is this is going to happen now, right? We read this now 2,000 years later, and we read this very, very differently than what the disciples would have thought of when they heard this. In fact, if you just back up, or if you go to Luke 19, he tells a parable that which we'll read at the end of Matthew 24. And in Luke 19:11, it says, as he heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable, because he was near to Jerusalem, and because, it says, they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. So that's what Scripture says. So the expectation was all these things were going to happen immediately. You have a question?
Well, I've kind of heard that because they seem to be two different things where
yes.
done, that even though they have a lot of similarities, there,
yeah.
that one is more focused on the things that will be happening real quick in
yes.
the 70s,
yeah.
and
yeah.
the other one is more focused on.
Yes, and I agree. I think Luke 21 is more focused. Now, Luke was a Gentile, right? So I have a sense that Luke's, you know, talking about the public discourse that he gave that would more concern the Gentiles, that he probably gave in the court of the Gentiles. Where in Matthew 24, it's the same essential message, different emphasis. Which is, so the Gentiles, they're gonna get out of there, right? Where they're gonna see this, the Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, and they're gonna get out of there. And where in Matthew 24, it's more for Matthew is more dealing with the Jews and basically giving them what's going to happen in the future, and in the distant future when Christ returns again, what to do. So yeah, I think there's some truth to that. But clearly their expectation, these were going to happen right away. This wasn't something that was going to happen in 2,000 plus years to them. I mean, even John the Baptist was said, you know, the axe is at the root of the tree, and these things weren't happening. He sent his disciples to Jesus' disciples, you know, are you the one? Or should we expect another? I mean, he wasn't seeing these things happening. So that was sort of confusing. So when they asked this, they're thinking, this is going to happen soon. When is this going to happen? So the other question is what's going to be the sign of your coming? What are we going to look for that we can look at to see that you're coming? And the third question is like it. He says, what will be the sign of the end of the age? Because they know that when he comes and does this, this is setting up the kingdom, and this is going to be the end. There's going to be a judgment, and there's going to be a kingdom established, and this is going to be the consummation of all things. And they want to know, when is that going to happen? And of course, their expectation was this was going to happen soon. So in Matthew 24, he answers from the Mount of Olives. That's why we call this the Olivet Discourse. Now, what's interesting is we've talked about this in Zechariah 14. According to Zechariah 14, when Christ returns and comes to earth and sets his feet on earth, he does so on the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives is split in two. There's part of the mountain will go north, part of that mountain will go south, and there'll be a stream, a river that goes in between. And so it's not. I don't think it's an accident that Christ is actually given the sermon right at the very place that he's going to return to. And as you sit on the Mount of Olives, you can look across to the west, across the Kidron Valley, and you could see the temple. Supposedly a staggering view. I've seen pictures of it, but it probably would have been more of something to see back in that particular day. So the answer to these questions, this is the longest answer to any question that Jesus was asked. And so it's going to compose of two full chapters in the book of Matthew. So this is kind of what we were just talking about. So as you read Luke 21 and you read Matthew 24, it's very similar content. Much of it's exactly the same. But there are some really, really key differences that you see between Luke 21 and Matthew 24. The one that sticks out to me is the warning of when to flee. In Luke 21, we'll see you flee when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. In Matthew 24, you flee when you see the abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation didn't happen by the Romans, right? That didn't happen. They did worship to Zeus, but they burned down the temple and they worshiped to Zeus outside the eastern gate. They didn't do it in the temple, and they didn't set up any kind of a statue to Zeus or anything in the temple. None of that part happened. So anyway, so some of the key differences here. So Mark 13 it reads very much like Matthew's version. Luke 21 is a little bit different. We'll look at some of the difference. So now he's going to answer these questions. So it says in Matthew 24:3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the close of the age? And Jesus answered them, see that no one leads you astray. Right? He begins with the exact same words in Luke. See that no one deceives you. This is really important to Jesus, that you not be deceived. Because evidently, deceit is going to be the norm during this time period that Jesus is about to enter. People are going to be deceived in a myriad of ways. They were deceived, and Josephus regales all these examples where all these false prophets had arose. And the slaughter was much worse because of these false prophets. You know, Titus was constantly trying to get them to surrender. He didn't want to burn the city, but they wouldn't. And largely, these false prophets told them that God would not let them destroy the temple. And they were wrong. And they were slaughtered. And their lives caught. So deception was very high during the destruction of Jerusalem, but it's also going to be high before Christ returns again. So he says, be not deceived. Christ is very concerned about deception. Because it's going to be very, very easy to be deceived. So he begins with that. He says, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray. So that's the first thing you see is you're going to see is false Christs. He says the same thing in Luke 21. So when you see these things happen, and the first thing you see is an uprising in false messiahs and false Christ. In fact, the second Jewish revolt in 135 AD was led by a false messiah. Everyone thought he was messiah. And so that was, and that was when the diaspora really occurred. The Jews were really spread after that point because the Romans really took care of making sure that they were scattered at that point. So false Christ will be one of the first things that you'll see is there'll be an abundance of false Christ. And there's plural. It says there's many of them. It's not like we know that there's going to be an antichrist that comes, but there are many false, there are many antichrists, as John says in 1 John. So there's going to be an abundance of false Christ. Now, by the way, in the first horseman of the apocalypse in Revelation 6, the first sign that you see, the first horseman is on a white horse and has a bow coming to conquer. So the general premillennial view is this is a false Christ. We know he's a false Christ because he doesn't conquer and bring peace, because the very next horse is war. And then the next horse is famine, and then the next horse is death. Right? This is not a Christ that really brings in peace. In fact, if you look at 1 Thessalonians 5:3, it talks, the very first thing it says when they say peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly. So I think Paul's describing the same thing in 1 Thessalonians 5. So the first thing you see are loads of false Christs. Things are going to look bad, and there's going to be all kinds of these false messiahs. No, just follow me. Do what I say, and you're going to be okay. But they're wrong. Much like in Jeremiah's time. They're loaded with false prophets in Jeremiah. You know, before the destruction of the first Jerusalem, there are all kinds of false prophets saying, no, Nebuchadnezzar's not going to destroy the temple. And it cost many people their lives because of that. So that's the first thing you see is false Christ. And that's what he begins with. And they will lead many astray. So there's going to be a great deception. So the first thing you have is a great deception. He says, and you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. So there's going to be wars and rumors and wars. So, and of course, that's the second horseman of the apocalypse. Right? If you look at in Revelation 6, the next horse is a horse, it's a rider's on a red horse, which brings war. And that's going to be the next thing that's indicative. It says nations are going to rise against nation. It says in verse 7, for nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of birth pains. In fact, that's what's talked about in 1 Thessalonians 5. These are the beginning of birth pains. So you begin with the false Christ, and then you have wars. And not just wars, you're going to hear about rumors of wars. There's going to be wars. There's going to be wars that aren't even wars that you're going to hear about. Right? It's going to be a massive upheaval in that regard. Yeah.
You can see how this, you know, somebody comes yeah. claiming Christ,
yeah.
and then somebody comes saying, "Well, he was a false Christ. I'm the real one."
Yes.
No, he was a false Christ. I'm the real.
Yeah,
one.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know when it stops.
Right.
I mean,
that's right. Right.
Trouble.
And there's Christ says there's going to be no doubt. Every eye will yeah. see him when Christ returns the next time. Right. There's not going to be any debate on who he is. Right. So there's going to be all these false. So you see all these wars. So war is going to be one of the next thing you see. Yeah. Go ahead.
What do you think the rumors of war? I don't quite get that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like when you read the news. There's going to be wars. There's going to be real wars going on, and then you're going to hear news about wars that aren't even real, right? There's going to be. But do we not get news that tells us about wars that don't exist, right? I mean, I would. I mean,
fake news.
I mean, yeah, and you're going to hear of all kinds. And, you know, back then too, they didn't have CNN and everything else too, and in fact. When they knew that the Romans were coming because they saw dead bodies floating down the Jordan and towards the river. And that was their sign that the Romans were coming, were dead bodies coming. And so...
That's
so,
real news.
Yeah, that's real news. Yeah, when you see dead bodies floating down, right? So, and it's not just men fighting each other. You're also now going to have cosmic upheaval. You're going to have things like earthquakes and all kinds of cosmic upheaval that's going to happen. Famine is going to be great, right? Then suddenly, you know, all the food sources are going to be gone. Right? And we know that was one of the worst things about the Roman occupation or the Roman destruction of Jerusalem, is there was so much infighting among the Jews themselves beforehand that they burned each other's food supply. And so there, and starvation was, they could have held out for a lot longer had they not starved themselves out. And so, and that was probably one of the worst things. Some of the people that survived said that was, dying wasn't the worst part, it was the famine, how horrific it was. That you had to endure this without any food at all. And there'll be earthquakes. And so these are going to be the things that, this is the beginning of birth pains. Why do you use birth pains? Well, I just know this through my wife, right? You know, I was one of these people, I did not want to have my child at home. I wanted to be in the hospital. I know there was I know people in the church, they want to have home birth. I was not into home birth. I wanted to be in a hospital where there were people that could take care of if anything goes wrong, and I'm actually glad that happened. And so I wanted to know when she started feeling pains, and I'm like, let's get to the hospital. And she was actually kind of mad because I got her to the hospital too quick. She wished she could have just stayed home more. Like, no. Because those birth pains, they become more intense and they become more frequent. And that's exactly the model that you have here. It's going to start off and the pain's going to increase and it's going to get more and more frequent. And you know something's building up. And this is the same term that's used in Jeremiah. So you saw this in Revelation. You see this here. You see this in 1 Thessalonians, this idea of birth pains. And I think that's the idea of the increasing pain and the increasing frequency of the pain. And you're going to build, it's building up to some particular event. So this is the beginning of birth pains. And it's horrific. If you read through the things that happen in the first six seals and in the seven trumpet judgments, much of the earth gets wiped out. I mean, just go through there and look. You know, you got a third of the seas, a third of the land, all the green grass. You know, all the animal life is dying. I mean, it's horrific, but that's just the beginning. Because we're going to enter into the last half, which is the Great Tribulation. And it's basically, as Christ is going to say later, these days were cut short because if they're not cut short, everybody's going to die. There are 7 billion people on this planet. And the vast majority, when this happens, the vast majority of people will die on this earth. By then, I mean, they say if we keep at this rate, what are we supposed to have by 2030, right? I don't know. There's far more people on the earth, or there's as many people on the earth today as there have been in all history, right? And it's going to increase at that point. Let's continue on here. These are the beginning of birth pains. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. So this is going to be a time when there's going to be great persecution. In fact, if you go back to Revelation 6, after the fourth horseman of the apocalypse, the next thing you have are the martyrs that are under the altar with their imprecatory psalm saying, How long, O Lord, until you revenge our blood? Right? These are the people that have died during this tribulation time period. So there's going to be a persecution, and there's going to be a large number of people that are actually die. And then many will fall away. There'll be a great apostasy. Okay? Now you see in the church, you have the wheat and the tares mixed, but when suffering and persecution comes, you're going to see things are going to separate, and many are going to fall away. So there'll be great apostasy. Many will fall and betray one another and hate one another. How can you tell a disciple of Jesus and how can you tell you're with Christians? It's because they love one another and they look after one another. That's not the way the world works. The world works, you love your friends and you hate your enemies, right? That's not the way it works in Christ's kingdom. And because of lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. That's an interesting implication. The increase of lawlessness causes love to diminish. That's interesting. If you don't think there's judgment coming, that changes your view. Yeah.
So, in the context then, the implication, when this apostasy comes, and, you know, and Christians mm-hmm. are facing this mm-hmm. false teaching that's coming up,
yeah.
there's this test,
yeah.
this love for one another.
Yes.
That, yeah. you know, it's not going to be like, oh, I've got this secret knowledge, or I understand
yeah.
this the right
yeah.
way, or I, you know,
yeah.
I'm listening to the right person. It's going to yeah. be this love.
And that's what Jesus says, right? Yeah. This is how you'll know my disciples. You're my disciples, right, if you love one another.
And we think that's important now, which it is.
Yeah.
But it's going to be super critical.
Yes. In fact, in the next chapter, we get to separate the sheep and the goats. That's an indicative of the sheep. When someone goes to prison, they take care of him. When someone doesn't have food, they feed him. Yeah. When someone doesn't have a shirt on their back, they give it to him, right? That's indicative of someone who follows Jesus. That's why Paul puts this in 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. I think that's the love chapter. But he says, if you have the gift of prophecy and you understand all mysteries and all knowledge, you don't have love, that's all pointless. Right.
So if the end times are coming and you're holed up in a foxhole guarding your little... That's a bad sign for you.
That's right. I am not stockpiling ammunition at my house. I've made a conscious decision that if it comes to that, I'm not going to be the guy taking out my neighbors, right? I'm going to, like, my neighbors want my food, fine, take it. I don't, you know. So, yeah. You'll be, they'll delay up to tribulation, put you to death, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. It's going to be a time when, I mean, it was that way in Jerusalem when the Romans attacked. It was horrific. If everyone thought you had food, like if you shut your door, oh, they must have food. They're going to break it down and take it from you and kill you, right? The one who endures to the end will be saved, right? Now you read that and you think, oh, I better hang in there. You know, if you have Jesus and you keep your eyes on Jesus, that's the key to endurance. And the saints of that time, it'll be their love for Jesus and their understanding of his coming that's going to allow them to persevere, right? Otherwise, there's no hope in persevering. You're not going to do this on the strength of your own flesh. Right? And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. This is something that mission people have used, saying that, you know, we got to get the gospel to the whole world so that we can obviate this second coming of Christ. That's not really what's happening here. So this is during the tribulation, the initial part of the tribulation period, and if my eschatology is right, we'll talk about this probably, hopefully next week or the week after, we'll start talking about this idea of this thing called a rapture and the church being ushered in avoiding this. We're getting there. So, but this is during the tribulation period. So how is the gospel going to be spread? Well, there's going to be, the gospel is going to spread like wildfire during this time period. And it's going to happen a lot of different ways. For one, you see in Revelation 7, you have the 144,000 Jewish witnesses. You have 12,000 from 12 tribes that are going to be sealed and marked by God. And they're going to be spreading the gospel. You also have another two witnesses that occur up, I think in Revelation 11, is the two witnesses. And they're going to be preaching from Jerusalem. And the whole world is going to hate them. Right? And finally, the Antichrist is going to overcome them. They're going to die, and they're going to leave their bodies dead in the street, and they're going to have a party because the witnesses are dead. They don't have to listen to these guys anymore, and everyone's excited. But then, after 3.5 days, they rise up from the dead, and then they leave, and everyone's kind of blown away. They're going to be witnessing. In fact, if you try to do anything against them, it says fire will come out of their mouth, right? I think this is going to be Moses and Elijah, because the very things they do, one's going to be turning rivers into blood, and the other one is, I think, is going to cause it not to rain. Who did those things? Moses and Elijah, right? I don't know. May not, it doesn't specifically name them, but it seems indicative. This is Moses and Elijah. But there's also, there's three angels. There's one angel, and what that angel does is this is a Revelation 14:6. It's the first angel. He travels the world spreading the everlasting gospel. So you're going to have an angel going around the entire earth delivering the gospel. Right? So just like in Noah's day, Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Noah was preaching up till the days that the ark came, he was preaching. So even during all this, there's going to be no lack of gospel being spread. People are going to hate it, but it's going to be there and it's going to spread. There's going to be, and it's going to infiltrate the entire earth. And God's going to get it, and everybody's going to get a chance, right? However that happens, God will spread his gospel. And so those are some of the mechanisms that will be there during that time period. And then the end will come. So these are the beginning of birth pains. So So here's a point where Matthew and Luke are a little bit different. So in Matthew 24, it says, "So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place," and it has, in parentheses, "let the reader understand," which I assume that this was meant to be written down and read by someone in the future, which would be us, right? "Let those who are in the Judea flee to the mountains." Right, so this is the sign to flee, is the abomination of desolation. Now turn to Luke 21, just to read a little bit different. He gets to this point in Luke 21. And it's kind of very, very similar, but in verse 20, he says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are inside the city depart. And let not those who are in the country enter it, for the days of vengeance to fulfill all that is written. Alas, for women who are pregnant, for those who are nursing infants in those days, for there will be a great distress upon the earth and wrath against this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled," are fulfilled. So Matthew says when you see the abomination of desolation, Luke says when you see the army surrounding. So this is a different signal, right? The signal here that Christ talks about in Matthew 24. I didn't read the whole thing. It says, "When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation such as not been from the beginning of the world until now and no and never will be." So that's the signal, and thankfully Christ points back to Daniel so we can know what he's talking about is this abomination of desolation. So I think here Luke's emphasis to the Gentiles, to the Christians that would be listening, is when you see the Romans surrounding the city, flee. Now this could be when Vespasian and Titus surrounded in 66, or it could be early when the legion started to surround, but there was a window of time when you can get out of Jerusalem, or if you're not in Jerusalem, don't go to Jerusalem, get out of there. And Eusebius, a 4th century early church father, claims that a great many of Christians had fled. In fact, most of the Christians had actually did take Jesus at his word, had fled, and lived up in an area called Pella, which is when early Christian churches was, right? Now, nobody knows where Eusebius got his information, but he claims that, probably through word of mouth, that there was a great number of Christians who actually took Jesus at his word and left the city. And there's actually one other early church father that repeats the same thing. So there's at least two early church fathers that have this claim. Nobody knows anything more about that than that. But my assumption is there would have been at least some fragment of people that would have heard Christ and would have saw Jerusalem being surrounded, that would have been in those court of Gentiles listening to this and would have fled and left there at that time. So there's a little bit of a difference. Now, they're different, but they're the same. In the sense that, and I'm going to talk about this in a bit, is God uses historical events as previews, prophetical previews of something bigger that happens in the future. The Bible is replete with this sort of thing. So, well, it sounds like Luke and Matthew are talking about different things, but in one sense, they're really talking about the same thing. There is going to be a destruction of Jerusalem, but that is just a historical picture of what it's going to be like just before the Great Tribulation that's going to happen before Christ returns. So I'm going to give a little. So even though they're kind of talking about different things, they're not really. They're really talking about the same thing. So that's why I remember when we were doing this in Life Group, Carol asked the great question: "Is this history or prophecy?" And I said, "Yes." Right. So when is this Great Tribulation? So Revelation, Daniel, both give us this number of, 1260 days, 42 months, time, times, and half a time, and half a week. So we talked about this in Daniel, this idea of this half. So in the middle of this week, there's going to be this time. If we looked in Daniel, in the middle of the week, there is going to be this covenant with Israel, this agreement they're going to have that's going to be broken in the middle of the week. So there's a seven-week period, a seven-year period. And the middle of the week is going to be the abomination of desolation. That's when the sacrifices will stop, according to Daniel 9:26. That's the sacrifices will stop. Up to that point, the Jews will be allowed to have their sacrifices. But the entry point is going to be when the temple is going to be desolated, and it's going to be abominated as well, is there's going to be something horrible set on the altar for people to worship. I believe this is what happens in Revelation 13 with the false prophet. He's going to set up his idol in the temple, and that's the abomination. That's the lead. Now, is this history, and we were looking at Daniel, is this history a prophecy? Because this is what Daniel foretold, but to him, there was a man named Antiochus Epiphanes that was going to do exactly this. And that happened in 168 BC. So as you know, we talked about this in pretty great detail, right? After Alexander died, there were four generals that came through from Alexander, right? And there was Seleucid, the two ones I remember well are Seleucid and Ptolemy, right? One's king in Syria, one is the king down in Alexandria in Egypt, and those are in Daniel 11, that's where you have the kings of the north against the kings of the south. Well, the eighth Seleucid king was a guy named Antiochus. His father was Antiochus the Great. He was Antiochus the Fourth, and he added to his name Epiphanes, which means God manifest. And he ended the daily sacrifice. He was a persecutor of the Jews. He went into the temple. He slaughtered pigs daily in the temple and set up a statue to Zeus. And he also, he didn't want people so much to worship Zeus. He wanted people to worship himself. Right? This is described in if you've got a Catholic Bible, you can read about this in 2 Maccabees 6, is how he slaughtered pigs on the altar, which would have been horrific to the Jews. And that was the abomination of desolation that happened. It's also this is also in Josephus, and it's also in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. There were 80,000 people that met their demise, it says. 40,000 were violently slaughtered, and another 40,000 were sold into slavery at that time, of Jews, people in Judea at that time. So, and this, of course, brought the whole Maccabean revolt, and the temple was finally, they were finally defeated. Antiochus met a very gruesome end, and he died, and they purified the temple. And during this battle, you know, it doesn't say this in Maccabees, but the Jewish tradition is that the lights, the oil lasted long than it should have, and the light stayed in the temple, and that was a sign. And they purified the temple. And I believe Jesus knew about this. In fact, I believe Jesus celebrated Hanukkah, because in John chapter 10, it says, as he was at the Feast of Dedication, and it was winter. It was December, right? The other feasts of the dedication of temple were in the fall and in the spring, right? The only feast of dedication in the winter would have been Hanukkah, would have been the feast of dedication after the Maccabean revolt. And so Jesus would have been aware of this. But you understand, in Matthew 24, Jesus doesn't treat this as history, right? This happened 200 years before, earlier, you know, 168 BC. But Jesus is talking about something yet future. So this is one example of how something that's historic is actually a picture of something else that will happen. So how is this going to happen? Well, if you read if you turn to 2 Thessalonians 2, you get this character called the Man of Lawlessness. And he sets up an idol in the temple, and everybody worships him. He doesn't want, he does exactly the same thing that Antiochus does. This man of lawlessness. If you read about this, matter of fact, let me just turn there real quick. In 2 Thessalonians 2. Beginning in verse 1 of chapter 2. Now, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered together, we ask you, brothers, not to be quickly shaken in mind or alarmed, either by spirit or a spoken word or a letter seeming to be from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. Let no one deceive you in any way, kind of like Christ said, right? For that day will not come unless the rebellion comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. Just like Antiochus named himself Epiphanes, God manifest, this man is going to claim that he is God. Do you not remember that when I was with you and I told you these things, and you know that what is restraining him now, restraining him now so that he may be revealed in his time? For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains it will do so until he is out of the way. So there's a man of lawlessness waiting that's being restrained. And then the lawlessness will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will kill with the breath of his mouth and bring to nothing by the appearance of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is by the activity of Satan with all the power and false signs and wonders. This is Revelation 13, right? And with all the wicked deception for those who are perishing because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. Therefore, God sends them a strong delusion so that they may believe what is false, in order that all may be condemned who did not believe in the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Right? Maps out everything Christ is talking about in Matthew 24. Maps out exactly what it has in Revelation 13. And it's exactly in the spirit of Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. Right? This is that man of law. So when he talks about abomination of desolation, the Jews would know immediately what to key on. That would have been Antiochus and the desolation of the temple, 168 BC. But now there's going to come another that's going to desecrate the temple, and that's when you get out of town. When you see that happen, you're out of there because sacrifices are going to stop, and that's going to be the end. Now, this implies that there's going to be sacrifices again. This implies, unlike what R.C. Sproul says, that there's going to be a temple rebuilt, and there's going to be sacrifices. Right? So this is a big difference between the amillennial and premillennial. I believe that a physical temple is going to be rebuilt, and there's going to be sacrifices, and it's going to be abominated again. That is not the amillennial view. Right? So the amillennial view mostly is these things happened somehow back in AD 70, but there's no recording of this kind of thing happening at all in any of Josephus' works of this happening. So that's where history and prophecy come together. And Scripture is rich with this. We use the term type and anti-type. Things in the Old Testament that paint a picture of something that's yet future. In fact, now God's the only one who can do this. He can take literal history and make it metaphor. He did this with the Exodus, right? There really literally was an Exodus, but yet that painted a picture of the Exodus of our deliverance from slavery, right? Even when Jesus was talking to Nicodemus about, you know, just as Moses lifted up the bronze serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That's a really loaded statement with a lot of theology in it. But that was a picture, that was a type, right? That of something that was born, that was dealing with the cross. That was a type of the cross and indicating the kind of way that Jesus would be crucified. Right? So this is the exact word. The Greek word is tupos or something like that. It's in Romans 5, for example, where it talks about Adam being a type of Christ and Christ being the second Adam. That was the idea. And the anti-type is the reality. Colossians and Hebrews like to use the word shadow and reality. There's the shadow of the law, then there's the reality. For instance, I believe that a Sabbath was a shadow for which Christ was the reality, right? Shadow was the shadow being the idea is you have a day of rest, a day when God will make you holy. But Jesus was the one who was, you know, I think that's why Jesus went on his way to heal on the Sabbath, to make a point that the Sabbath was the shadow for which he was the reality. Right? And so I think the abomination of desolation by Antiochus was a shadow of the one that's going to happen when the Antichrist comes. The destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 was a shadow of what it's going to be like when Christ, just before Christ returns. So these things are both history and future. Right? So both are brought into view. At least that's my view, and that's the common premillennial view that you have in these things. Because there's too many things that happened in Matthew 24 that did not happen in AD 70. There's a lot of things that did happen, right? This idea of women having children, it's going to be horrific. Yeah, women, it was horrible. I just want to bring it up. It was horrific what women had to do with their children during that time period in AD 70. But that is not... So some of those things happened. But there was no desecration. There was a desolation, but not a desecration, and not an abomination of the temple. None of that happened in AD 70. And the moon, you know, there were some earthquakes, and there was darkness, but there was not the kind of cosmic upheaval that's described in Revelation by any stretch. And I don't remember any locusts coming out of a bottomless pit, right, with scorpion tails. And I look at Revelation, I mean, someone who's a preterist has to look at those and say, those things happened at this one localized area on the earth. Revelation, you get a sense, this is the entire earth. You know, AD 70 was a localized region. That was just Jerusalem that was being destroyed. I mean, if you lived, you know, up in Britain at the time, right, you wouldn't have known about this happening. That you don't get that sense in Revelation. The entire earth is involved there. So I think the preterists have the type and the anti-type, the shadow and the reality mixed up. Yeah.
There's another difference there too. I'm sure maybe you've already mentioned that.
Sure.
In 21, in Luke 21, there's the disciples being taken before the governors and
yeah.
the kings does
yeah.
lead to an opportunity to hear testimony.
Yes.
But in Matthew 24, it's actually the gospel preached to the whole world.
Yeah.
So there's a difference in the
yes. total. Yes. But yes. So read. I'm not being exhaustive. There's other differences there, and it's interesting. So they're the same, but some of the emphasis is different on whether you're focusing on AD 70 or the ultimate event, right? And that's where people get confused. Is it one or the other? Well, it's kind of both, right? Well, let's see if we can make it a quick one.
If the Jews were warned by Jesus to leave in the
yeah.
first discussion,
yeah.
can you take that to Revelation? Where are they going to flee to?
Oh, we know. We Revelation 12. In Revelation 12, now Zechariah says 2/3 of the Jews are going to be killed.
Right.
Right? Holocaust, what percentage of Jews were killed under Hitler? It was 70 million Jews. It was about 1/3 of the Jews on earth, right? And this is going to be 2/3 of the Jews are going to be killed, according to this. But what happens to the rest? God is going to preserve them.
They don't have to flee.
So Revelation 12, they are going to flee. In Revelation, the Jews are going to flee. It says God has a place prepared for them in the wilderness. You remember the whole business? Satan's going to, the dragon's going to try to flood them out, but God's going to, the earth's going to like swallow up the water. Yeah. So there's going to be a remnant of Jews that somehow flee somewhere in the Jordan, somewhere in the east, in the wilderness, and God's going to preserve them. And it's going to make Satan really, really mad because he can't get to them. Because God, so there is going to be a group that are going to flee, and God's going to preserve them. So I think Christians in the first century that had fled were saved and were preserved, and there's going to be Jews in the tribulation that God's going to set aside. Yeah, that's.
Some people think they're going to Petra, but Satan knows about Petra.
So we've been over this Daniel timeline, so just for sake of time, I'll move on. So Jesus says, he uses the word, this great tribulation. He says, verse 21 of chapter 24, "For then there'll be great tribulation, such as not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be." Now you think about all the horrific things that have happened in history. I mean, for me, the thing that comes to mind immediately is the Holocaust and the gassing of Jews and the things that happened at, you know, in the various concentration camps and how horrible that was. This is going to be more horrific. It's going to be the worst time of all. Now, that's another thing, this difference between Jerusalem. The destruction of Jerusalem was horrible, horrific for people that were there, but it was localized. Right? This was not a worldwide great tribulation by any stretch. But there's going to be a worldwide tribulation, and it's horrific. So we enter into this great tribulation. Now, where do you actually make the dividing line of the judgments in Revelation? In Revelation, you know, you start with the seven seals. And I think they telescope. I think the seventh seal contains the seven trumpets. And then the seventh trumpet contains these seven bowls, which indicate these sort of wrath being poured in these bowls, and these angels dump out this wrath. Those bowl judgments that finally come at the end, where most of humanity, all of humanity, would be wiped out had it not been cut short. So you enter this time where that's. So you already have this tribulation already beginning in the first half of the tribulation. That is not a peaceful time by any stretch. But in this last 3.5 years, this last 42 months, is going to be horrific for those that are left on the earth. In Revelation 12, right, Satan is going to be thrown to the earth, and it says, "Rejoice heavens, but mourn for the people on earth," because Satan knows his time is short. There's going to be a 3.5 year period of intense tribulation, and Jesus calls this the great tribulation. Jeremiah 30 calls this the time of Jacob's trouble. Right? This is a time. Jacob is another word for Israel. This is a suffering, a time for Israel to suffer. Right? We'll talk about that more when we talk about why I don't think many reasons why I don't think the church is the emphasis here. This is a time of Jacob's trouble. This is a time of Israel's judgment. Right? Yeah. If you read through the various trumpet, sealed trumpet, and bowl judgments, the earth. You know, there's a point where the entire water is completely gone. The seas are turned into blood. So I think by the time you get to Revelation 16, those are the bowl judgments. That's the time of this last intense 3.5-year great tribulation period. So you better get out. You better flee. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. God's going to make sure that there's going to be some that are preserved. And those are going to be the people that are going to enter the kingdom. That if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. Right? They're going to be a great amount of deception. I believe they'll be able to do miracles. Satanic miracles. It seems to me the false prophet will be able to mimic some of the things that Elijah does, like bring fire out of heaven. That's why it says they would deceive the elect if that were possible. Right? They will be able to give signs and very convincing signs, but it won't be possible to deceive those who know Jesus. So he warns them of this, who know Jesus, right? See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. He's saying, look, when Jesus comes back, you're going to know it. It says in Revelation 1, the whole earth's going to see it. There's going to be no ambiguity about the Messiah. So if you hear someone saying that the Messiah is somewhere in some, he's on some particular blog on the internet, or if he's in, you know, that's not, right? Don't go to that, right? You know, there's going to be zero ambiguity when Christ returns. And it's going to be like lightning from the east to the west. It says, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather, right? Have you ever been driving out and you can see vultures sort of circling? And you're like, oh, what's over there? Something either is dying or died or is about to die, right? There's that idea of something's going to happen. There's vultures circling. And we know in Revelation 19 and Ezekiel 38 and 39, there's the great feast, the carrion that eat the flesh of the kings and the slaves, right? The carrion are gathering. They see something coming. And then he says this. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. So here's the return. So this is the culmination after this 3.5-year period. Jesus Christ is going to return. Now look at the events that are going to happen. It talks about the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will not fall from heaven. In Zechariah 14, it describes this as a very unique day. It's a dark day. You're not going to be able to tell day from night. It's going to be a very special day. But that's going to be indicative of the fact that the sun's going to be blotted out, the moon's going to be blotted out, the stars are going to be blotted out. It's going to be dark. The whole earth is going to be dark. And then the Son of Man's going to return, and everyone's going to be able to see him in the midst of that. This is the same thing that Joel talks about in chapter 2 and in chapter 3, is it talks about the sun being blotted out, right? All this cosmic darkness that's going to envelop the land just before, at the end of the tribulation, and that's when Christ is going to appear. Right? Yeah.
When, in these verses right here that you're talking about, when it talks about the elect, lots of times this is Israel, not believers.
Well, it's a mix. I think during the tribulation, the gospel is going to get spread, and both Jews and Gentiles are going to follow Jesus during that time period. So this is tribulation saints. And in fact, these are the people I think talk about at the beginning of Revelation 20. These are the people that came out of the Great Tribulation. They're all clothed in white, right? These are the people that were martyred and were killed, or the saints, and some of the saints that survived. Yeah. So there's going to be...
So you don't think this is just talking about Israel?
No, I think this is the all the elect. Now, there's going to be a great number of Jews, right? We know there's at least 144,000 Jews that are going to be part of that elect.
I believe that.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's going to be Gentiles, too. There's going to be people that are going to come to Christ during this time period. Yeah.
After the rapture, the church is gone. Right. And then people will become Christians after that.
Yeah. When I heard people talk about this, they're saying this word in particular is describing Israel. We're not talking about...
Now, I would agree in the sense that the emphasis is on Israel. But here, I think you have all the elect, all the saints that come out of the tribulation. There'll be a great number of Jews and a great number of Gentiles. In fact, there'll be a huge multitude of people.
Well, I totally believe that.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying is true.
Yeah.
But I'm just talking about, when it's talking about this
here,
this section of Scripture.
Possibly. I think it's all the tribulation saints. Yeah. And it says, then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. This is another key off of Zechariah 13, where it talks about, in Revelation 1, this is exactly what it says in Revelation 1. When Christ returns, they will see the one whom they have pierced, and they will mourn as one mourns for an only son, it says in Zechariah 13. This is also referenced in John at Christ's actual crucifixion, right? When they see the one they've pierced. So they will see, and they will realize that's the point where Israel will recognize their Messiah. Those are the ones who pierced him, right? They're going to recognize their Messiah, and it says the floodgates of the house of David are going to open up, it says in Zechariah 14. And so this is maybe the Jewish part you're talking about. Then, as it says in the book of Romans, all of Israel will be saved. There'll be a mass conversion of Jews during that time at Christ's return. They'll understand who their Messiah is. They'll survive, and they'll have a mass conversion at that particular time. Yeah.
About referring to all Israel that converts to Christianity at that time.
Yes.
Which, as opposed to all Jews who have ever lived.
No, I think it's during that time, right? The ones that see him coming, and that's why I get out of Zechariah 13 and the flood, and then they're going to mourn. They're going to put on sackcloth and ashes, and they're going to mourn because they realized who the Messiah was, and they realized what he did for them and why he died for them, and they haven't seen that for all this time. They didn't recognize their Messiah. We'll start with a time of mourning, which is very appropriate, right? That's a great first step towards repentance, is mourning. Right?
That is different than the way some people interpret that, though. Mm-hmm. People think, well, all Israel, all these Jews in the world now, they're going to be saved.
Yeah, I think but universally the surviving Jews will be saved. I think what Paul says in Romans, I think that's what Zechariah is saying.
Yeah, that's different than saying a Jew alive today who doesn't end up is going to be saved just because they're Jews.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I think that's what I get from this time period. Yeah. And they'll see the Son of Man coming. Now, what's interesting, I always think about this, is remember when Christ was on trial before Caiaphas? He told Caiaphas, he quoted Daniel 7 saying, you'll see the, he's like, Caiaphas was insistent, are you the Christ? And Jesus said, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds with great, sitting at the right hand of God, coming on the clouds of glory. And that's when Caiaphas ripped his clothes, right? Because he saw Jesus was blaspheming. So I was wondering, well, how's Caiaphas going to see this? Then maybe that plays into the question you're just asking. But I take Jesus at his word that somehow Caiaphas is going to witness this from some vantage point. I don't know how, because he'll be dead, but he's dead now, right? So there's going to, somehow Caiaphas is going to witness this particular event. In fact, this is exactly, he's coming on the clouds. Now, when we get to talk about, I'll give you this little preview of the rapture. When we look at Christ, there's a very different thing that's happening in John chapter 14 and in First Thessalonians 4, where Christ comes back to take his saints home before this time period, there's no judgment. And there's no clouds turning dark. So we're going to talk about this. There's a different time that when Christ is going to not come to earth. He's going to come and not come to earth, but he's going to there's going to be this translation of believers that are going to come out and meet Christ in the air. And he's going to take them home. And there's no... the sun's not going to be darkened and all these things. This is a very different, distinct event. This is right at his final return. Well, let's look at the lesson of the fig tree. And obviously, we didn't even get to Matthew 25. You were right, Galen. I knew I had no chance. I could hope.
This means we have more days and we yeah. can do this. So, I like that.
He says, from the fig tree learn its lesson. As soon as the branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. Right? That's interesting. This is a fig tree. And there's lots of opinions about the fig tree. The thing that comes to mind to me immediately is, you know, when Jesus is going to Jerusalem and he went to find a fig on a tree to eat, and there was no fruit there, and he immediately caused it to wither. I mean, that isn't just a story that God was mad at a fig tree, right? That must represent something bigger than that, because this is right in the context of Jesus weeping over Jerusalem, because they didn't know the time of his coming. They didn't know the time of his visitation, and they weep over Jerusalem. And that, so this fig tree, in some sense, represents the fact that it's the opposite of here, right? It's not the greening of the fig tree. He did the opposite. He took a green fig tree that didn't have any fruit, and he withered it. Now you've got the reversal of that process. Right? Winter has passed, and now the leaves are starting to bud, and now you see something, right? Something is happening in here. And Luke, it doesn't just say the fig trees. It says the fig trees and all the trees. So just to let you know, there's a lot of different opinions, but I can't dismiss the withering of the fig tree and then the becoming of the fig tree. Now, in the last century, a lot of people took this to mean that when Israel became a nation in May something, 1948, right, that this had to be the final generation because of what Jesus is going to say next. And they take that as the budding of the fig tree. At the time, it was a pretty convincing argument. I remember, you know, all the books by Hal Lindsey and all that sort of thing. So people had all kinds of things. But so obviously, how much you read into that, I don't know. But there is a sign. There is something that's coming, that there's going to be this greening of the fig tree that you're going to see, this regathering of Israel or something that's going to happen. That's going to be a sign. And you're going to know. You're going to know that this is going to happen. You see these things, you know that it is near at the very gates. Truly, I say... Now, this is the thing that people get hung up on. He says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So we'll end on this particular thought. So this is a phrase that has lots of different opinions. And what is this? And so the preterist will say this. Look, it says this generation, right? And they'll make the argument, you know, if you go back to how long was Israel in the wilderness for that generation to die away, you know, it was 40 years, whatever, it was 40 years, you know. So we know that it was, you know, about 40 years until the Romans, you know, so the preterists will, until Romans destroyed Jerusalem, and they'll say, see, that's the generation that saw Jerusalem, and that's true. And I think in Luke, you could probably take it that way. But the problem with that interpretation is these things all didn't happen in AD 70. Right? There was no, I don't think the return of Christ and the darkening of the, I don't think that happened, right? And then we know there are key elements, and there's much written in the book of Revelation that did not happen in AD 70, unless you take a very metaphorical, non-literal view of the things in Revelation. But even if you decide to make that, all these things have to mean something, right? Those, I always think of the locust coming out of the abyss. Okay, let's say that's a complete metaphor. What's it mean? And, okay, if that's a metaphor, well, how does that metaphor map to anything that happened in AD 70? Right? I just can't. So, I mean, I do tend to take it more literally, but even if you take it metaphorical, the metaphor still has to mean something, right? So I don't think that can be. So I think, well, who's the generation? Well, some people say the generation, and I don't know Greek. I can pretend I know Greek, but I don't really know Greek. So I never live in a fraternity or anything. But anyway, so... Some people say that means race, and say that Israel will not die off before this happens, right? So, now I think it's the generation that is the witness of these things that we see. It's the generation that sees these things, right? So I actually kind of have a double meaning to it. I think those that saw the Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, that generation would see the thing, some of the things you're talking about. But ultimately, the real thing is the generation of people that witnessed these things during the tribulation. The tribulation will be shortened enough that they'll be able to see these things happen. So it's the generation that witnesses these signs is the generation that sees it. That's the way I read it. I can't. It doesn't seem like the other interpretation does justice to what Scripture says about what actually happened in history and what hasn't happened. So
70 years and a few weeks.
Yeah. Oh, if you do, well, is the generation 70 years, right? You know, of course, you're using solar years, not right, not right. So anyway, so we end there, and that's something of big controversy. You know, what is this generation? And people have all kinds of opinions. So, yeah, we can talk about it. We're out of time. We're over time. Sorry about that. I'll close in prayer. Jesus, we do long for you to come, and we just realize the time is short and that we need to be ready and for you to come and just walk with us this week. And thank you for your grace and your mercy to us. In Christ's name, amen.